From Human Angle, this is the Crisis Room. I'm Salma. Unfortunately, something tragic happened recently, and we'll be discussing the event as it shapes the crisis landscape of Nigeria. This episode is on Nigeria's stolen classrooms. Between 2014 and 2025, at least 1,880 students have been abducted across Nigeria. It's a staggering number on its own, but it becomes even heavier when you realize that these are children whose dreams, confidence, and sense of safety have been repeatedly disrupted. And this tragic pattern continues. Just this Monday, November the 17th, in Kebbi State, at least 25 students of the Government Girls Comprehensive Secondary School abducted in Maga. For many people, the Chibok abductions is the reference point because of how widely they were publicized and also due to the number of the children that were abducted. But the very first major school attack was actually in Bunyadi, Yobe, in 2014. And since then, states like Borno, Yobe, Katsina, Zamfara, Niger, Kaduna, and Kebbi have experienced repeated violations of children's right to learn in peace. On today's episode, we will be discussing with Professor Awel Inua the effects of these abductions on children. Now, before we bring Professor Awel into the conversation, I want to take a moment to discuss with Hawasha Afinuhu, Managing Editor here at Human Angle. So Hawa, as someone who has covered this issue for years, the early abductions, the evolution of the ideology behind them, the copycat kidnappings for ransom, and the inconsistency in Nigeria's response, I would like to start by asking this. From Human Angle's reporting, how did this abduction begin? And how has the motive evolved over the past decade?
Hi, Selma. Thank you for having me. Like you mentioned earlier, the first major school attack in Nigeria was the Bunyadi massacre of 2014, where over 29 or at least 29 schoolboys were killed in their dormitories at the secondary school. But the first case of abduction was actually, well, the first major case of abduction of schoolgirls was actually the Chibok abduction. So answer your question on how it started, I would say that it started from there. One important aspect to know of the Chibok abduction, however, that I don't think a lot of people know is that it was not a planned attack. It was not that Boko Haram sat down and decided, ooh, let's seize some girls from school.
It was spontaneous.
Yeah, it was spontaneous. It was that they were on their way to another location for a different attack. And on their way, they realized that the school was unguarded and they could just go in and get over 270 schoolgirls without any form of resistance from security forces. The case can be made that because an attack of that magnitude had never happened before, it was impossible to tell if our security forces or mechanisms were fortified enough to have been able to repel it. So, but a lot more have happened since then, and so we know for sure now that the security architecture of the country is not necessarily designed in a way that makes it possible for these attacks to be repelled. Aside from the Chibok abduction, we have seen several other mass abductions, especially targeted at young girls. We have seen the Dapchi abduction, which I extensively covered. We have seen the Birni Yaori abduction, which I covered as well. We have seen the Jengebe abduction, the Tegina abduction, so many other abductions. And the way that women and girls experience these abductions are disproportionately worse than the way that men experience these abductions. One primary example that comes to mind is the Birni Yaori girls. Even though all the others, including the boys, had been released, about 11 or 12 of the girls were held for a period of 12 years, 2 years in total. And during this time, they were subjected to a lot of sexual violence, which led to one of the girls as young as 14 conceiving and even giving birth to a baby. The issue of the kind of stigma that they face when they came home is another topic entirely, but it is an example of how women and girls are affected differently from men or boys when these abductions occur. So what we are seeing in the Northwest are not necessarily ideologically motivated abductions. for the Northeast because the actors are Boko Haram and ISWAP. Their ideologies are rooted in the fact that Western or conventional education is haram, which is forbidden in Arabic. And so even when the Dapchi girls were snatched, they were released because they decided that they had warned them and so they would not go back to school anymore. The abductions happening in the Northwest are more economically and sometimes politically motivated by terror groups operating within the region.
Thank you, Hawa. That throws more light with regards to what's currently happening. But if you could also speak to how motive is evolving, because you just mentioned that one major motive is that they see Western education as haram, which is forbidden. But the narrative that they are currently pushing and with the way that they are currently operating, I think there's sort of like a mismatch, isn't there?
Yeah. Well, for like I said, there are groups that operate with ideologically motivated intentions, and then there are groups that operate with economic and sometimes political intentions. So for those, well, one common trait that both of these groups have is that they also see women as a means to procreate children that would be loyal to their ideologies and to their cause. So it is not unsurprising to see cases where women are deliberately impregnated while they are in captivity so that they are able to give birth to children that can grow up within these violent ideological groups and are able to carry forth the violence that their parents have been known for. So, for example, the Birnin Yauri abduction, even though it was economically motivated because, you know, ransoms were paid and all of that before the girls were released, there was also the fact that despite the sexual abuse and after the girls were finally released, Dogo Gide, the mastermind of the attack, started reaching out to their families, demanding that the babies be returned to him, which meant that he was passionate about having a lot more kids within his group. Like some kind of legacy. We have seen similar things happen, particularly in the Northeastern region. We have seen insurgents warn their wives to say that if their wives ever wanted to escape from Sambisa or desert the group, they should not go with their children because they see their children as some sort of property that can carry forth their legacy. So in terms of motive, there is money, obviously, because, you know, abduction, ransoms and all of that, even though Nigeria insists on not paying ransoms, at least officially. And there is the religious motive. There's also the absolute belief in a lot of these groups that children should simply not go to school. So they're targeting schools because they literally snatch them away from education, but they also sow fear in a lot of other people. And this can also be seen in how a lot of schools, particularly in places like Niger State, have been shut down completely, not because they have been attacked, but because there are fears that they would be attacked. So the strategy is working as sad as it is. Yeah.
Thank you very much, Hawa. We will now go ahead and speak with Professor Awol. Thank you for making the time, Professor. From your experience, how have repeated school abductions and attacks affected students' willingness to return to classrooms?
Whenever school is not safe, whenever school is not accommodating, whenever school has been a terrifying ground, and whenever pupils, students, are not having a clear, safer ground for teaching and learning, the interest, the willingness, the courage, all will go. Second thing is, on a general note, security is an issue that people don't compromise, and an issue that individuals don't compromise, society don't compromise. And security with the issues of health challenges and social, physical security, ideological security, all this matters. Convincing person to redirect his idea, his thinking, his philosophy, his perspective towards acceptance of certain nature of challenges in school is equally challenging. So the rural northern Nigerian, by initiation, have been going through a lot of backwardness in terms of accepting even Western education clearly, plainly, without doubt. And now, with the existence of the schools in many of the northern Nigerians, and yet we face issues of social, physical, ideological, cultural insecurity. Not going to the school alone is even a claim for a child to see it as a means of protecting his integrity, tradition, culture. And now with so many nature of exogenous, porous attacks coming into the school day in, day out, and people keep going to the school under the watch of serious doubt, all both schools and everything becomes vulnerable, then there is no sense of compliance to the national policy on education or issues that relate to safety of schools. Therefore, attack is a serious threat to it.
Thank you for your response. And you're actually right. The willingness to go to school was even minimal in the first place. And with these attacks, it is becoming something else. Which brings me to my next question. What gaps do you see in Nigeria's current implementation of the Safe Schools Initiative, and what practical steps could make schools genuinely safer?
Presently, going by what is on ground in this country, there's no sincerity of commitment towards initiating anything that will keep schools safer. You don't know who and who are for the school and those who are not for the school. You plan a safety where even the traditional people are not interested. You plan a safety means where even the government policy is just a mere paperwork. You plan the policy where politicians are not committed. You see, one good thing Nigerians should have tried to do presently today is the ability to capture back the sense of patriotism towards sacrifice for the nation, whereby people will see dying and living for the country as a worthy thing to do. But the initiate policy, and the policy will not be working. And whoever you are calling initiating, whoever is talking today, whoever is initiating any, whoever is even carrying any type of research, the hidden primary goal is how to better his account. What will come out of it? But the willingness for sacrifice for the nation to develop, for the initiative to progress, is not actually the fact. The country is big enough to secure all the entire country. Using our forces, using our policemen, using our migration, using our custom officers, using all other agents of security and social control, are not there holistically to monitor, take care, and put it in shape. And the nation and citizens have not been taught to understand that really everybody is supposed to stand as a watchdog towards the issues of this country, that everybody is supposed to serve as a CCTV.
I do see your perspective, Professor, but I also believe that it's not a lack of trust, but more of a lack of coordination. To round up our conversation, I would like to ask you one final question, Professor. Do you think Nigeria's education policies have adapted to the reality of teaching during insecurity? And what changes would you recommend to make learning more resilient in conflict zones?
If Nigerians have either initiated a way to teach during conflict or during insecurity or whatever, I think Nigerian is big enough, bold enough, strong enough, wealthy enough in every state to create an emergency schools everywhere. What is being practiced now and what has been done, I don't see anything formidably good for the futures of Nigerians. As far as I'm concerned, based on either practical, theoretical, personal perspectives, Nigeria only plays with the intelligence of Nigerians. What is the truth is different. What is being proposed is different. What the people see is different. What they are expecting is different.
We just heard from Professor Awol about how repeated school attacks are reshaping the willingness of children to return to classrooms, much so in line with what Howard mentioned, that the strategy that these bandits are employing is working. When a school is not even minimally accommodating, let alone safe, students naturally lose interest. As both of them have pointed out, the problem is not just about the attack themselves, it's about the complete absence of genuine security.
Absolutely, Selma, you're right. Just like I said earlier, beyond the attacks themselves, it also feeds into fear and paranoia that a lot of people have, especially in conflict-affected areas. And this can also be seen in survivors of abductions. Whenever we as in Human Angle go back to have conversations with them, there is one central theme in a lot of these conversations, which is that they no longer feel as safe to go back to school. So there are students that, despite having received full scholarships, have vehemently refused to go back to school, like some of the Yauri girls. The Kebbi State government has done very well as regards trying to help them rebuild their lives, enrolling them in one of the best schools in Nigeria, ensuring that they have access to all the kinds of support that they have and that they need. Mm-hmm. But there are still one or two girls who simply refuse to ever go back to school. So it is as much a physical warfare as it is an emotional and mental warfare, because not only does it limit actual children or actual women and girls, it also limits their ability to dream and their ability to reinvent themselves in gainful and meaningful ways in the society. So if before an abduction, a girl had the dream of becoming a doctor, that dream would not have to change because she had been scarred mentally and even physically because she dared to go to school. So we see a lot of this, not just with the Yauri girls, but also with the Dapchi girls that I have spoken to. A lot of them are not in school. They have no intentions of going back to school. And the same can be seen for the Chibok girls. Some of the Chibok girls even dropped out, even though the government had enrolled them at the American University of Nigeria in Yola. So we see a lot of the manifestations of this genuine absence of security and how it continues to impact the way that women and girls not only see themselves, but are able to imagine a future for themselves.
Looking at the Safe Schools Initiative, an initiative to create protective spaces for children, we have heard from the professor and also from Hawa right now that the commitment from the government to make schools safer is weak. And this is evident in the consistent attacks that are happening in Nigeria. This supports the statement. So as we conclude this episode, I want to leave us with a question. How do we rebuild a system where safety is made a priority and where every child can walk into a classroom without fear?
Whew. Thanks, guys.
Thank you, Hawa.